reflections that you've compiled into your word. I pray that you would give us eyes to see and ears to hear, that we would see what it is that you've taught, and that you would protect us from ideas and words and everything else that have their origination in me. Help us to better understand how it is that you worked through Solomon, and how it is that Solomon's reign can have such disparate extremes like David's, except more. Please bless this time, and may it all be for your glory. In Christ's name, amen. So, the last week or two, we've talked about kind of the beginning of, or the end of David's reign and the beginning of Solomon's reign. Now we're going to, Solomon is now on the throne, and so we're going to start out by talking a little bit about Solomon. So, just before we get started here, what do you know about Solomon? Yep. Talkative bunch this morning. Anything about Solomon? David's son, okay. He wrote Proverbs, at least a significant chunk of them. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We'll get there. Yep. He built the temple. Absolutely. That's a huge one. Any other books that are typically? Yeah. There's definitely that. Yep. Song of Solomon. Ecclesiastes is typically attributed to Solomon. Mm-hmm. Yep. So typically when we talk about Solomon, the first thing that comes to everybody's mind is wisdom. And we'll see here in just a second that when he's on the throne, one of the first things that happens is he has this encounter with God where God asks him, basically, choose your blessing. And Solomon can ask for just about anything. And Solomon chooses to ask for wisdom. And so it's kind of interesting because we see that Solomon begins really well. And that's kind of how we're going to start out today. And we'll see here in a bit that Solomon also ends pretty badly. So, if you would, turn with me to 1 Kings 3. Alrighty, so would somebody like to start at 1 Kings 3, verse 2, and we'll read down through verse 10. 1 Kings 3, verse 2 to verse 10. Somebody like to read it for us? Kim, thank you. So what happened? We kind of summarized it a little bit, but okay. So what were the high places at this point? Well, in this case, it's Gibeon. Yeah. So let's go ahead and talk a little bit about that. Maybe all my notes didn't actually make it over. So the high places. Oh, that there it is. I'm just doing this a little bit out of order. That's all. Okay. So the high places in Canaan, when the Israelites first come in, the high places are the places where the peoples who were in Canaan before that worshipped their gods. And so these high places, because they're at the tops of mountains and things of that nature, they become, people view them as being closer to God. Yeah, very much so. Tower of Babel. If you think about like Greek mythology, right? Everything's up at the top of Mount Olympia. Yeah, literally at the top of these mountains is where the gods live. And this is something that seems to transcend different regions and different mythologies. And so here we see that, yeah, that when those people would go worship their gods, they would go worship in the high places. And so the Israelites, at this point, there isn't a temple that exists. They have the tabernacle, but the tabernacle moves. So, you know, does everybody always know where it's at? Things of that order. So if we look back at Deuteronomy 12, this portion of Deuteronomy is what's known as the law of centralization. And so I'm going to read Deuteronomy 12, verses 1 to 14. These are the statutes and rules that you shall be careful to do in the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you to possess all the days that you live on the earth. You shall surely destroy all the places where the nations whom you shall dispossess served their gods on the high mountain, and on the hills, and under every green tree. You shall tear down their altars, and dash in pieces the pillars, and burn their Asherim with fire. You shall chop down the carved images of their gods, and destroy their name out of that place. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. But you shall seek the place that the Lord your God will choose out of all your tribes to put his name, and make his habitation there. There you shall go, and there you shall bring your burnt offerings and your sacrifices, your tithes and your contributions that you present, your vow offerings, your freewill offerings, and the firstborn of your herd and of your flock. And there you shall eat before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household, in all that you undertake, in which the Lord your God has blessed you. You shall not do according to all that we are doing here today, everyone doing what is right in his own eyes. For you have not, as yet, come to the rest and to the inheritance that the Lord your God is giving you. But when you go over the Jordan and live in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to inherit, and when he gives you rest from all your enemies around so that you live in safety, then to the place that the Lord your God will choose to make his name dwell there, there you shall bring all that I commanded you. And I'm going to stop there. What's happening here is, again, we have, still doesn't want to stay open. We have all of these other peoples who are offering sacrifices to their gods in these high places. And when the Israelites come in, they're dispossessing these people of the land. And yet, God knows that these places, even these shrines, these former gods of the land, will be a temptation to the Israelites, and so they're to destroy them. They're an abomination before God, and an abomination to despoiling the land. And so the picture of the conquest is almost a picture of judgment and recreation. So God is wiping out, he's judging the things that have gone on here before, and he's bringing in something new. And so they're to destroy these things, and yet, while the Israelites aren't to do what those who were there before them did, they are to worship their God in some way. And so we have this period of time now, which we're looking at right now, that we haven't hit the point where God has said, it's Jerusalem. It is this place in this city where you will come. So we haven't actually had the centralization piece of it yet. That's coming here pretty shortly, actually. But we've also been told that they're not to do this other stuff. And so the people are going and trying to worship God in these places. And it's kind of one of those challenging pieces of, were they right to do that or were they wrong to do that? So what version are you reading out of, Kim? Okay, New King James. So in New King James, they translate it with the word accept in the First Kings passage. So the First Kings 3, something to the effect of, and the king, or Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of David his father, except he sacrificed and made offerings at the high places. Yeah. And that's certainly one of the options there. And yet, so like the ESV says only he didn't do these things. It kind of takes away some of the, so it's, the it's nitpicking. It's nitpicking. So accept would say God has this against him. Only kind of leaves open the option that this isn't really the best way to go about things. And yet, it's telling them that they can't worship God in the way that they worshiped those other gods until such time as God has declared his place. Diane. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And so we know that there's a time coming when God has settled his people and he will plant that stake in the ground. If you remember when we talked about the Davidic covenant, we talked about part of the reason why David was not the king is because Israel had not come to this point of rest yet. No, so do you remember about a month ago we talked about kind of this idea of semantic range? Okay, so that's kind of where it's going in. So the Hebrew words typically have a broader range of meaning than English words do. And so it may be that we have two or three English words that draw out different angles of that Hebrew word. Does that make sense? And certainly that's one of the possible meanings. I don't want to say for sure that it doesn't mean that. But what I do want to say is that it's saying, at the very least, it's saying that this is not the ideal way that Solomon could have gone about this. The reason I'm drawing a little bit of a hesitation is we'll see here in a little bit, is that Solomon actually does go build high places to these foreign gods and go worship and sacrifice at them. And so it may be looking forward to the future when it draws that accept. Does that make sense? So, yeah. So we'll see that. The way that it's written, it's not necessarily saying right here, right now. If I had a board, we could probably diagram that out a little bit more easily. But, Earl? Yes. Yeah. Well, and yeah. Well, and since David already brought the ark into Jerusalem, he knows where it is. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so that's a really difficult question to answer. Is the short answer of it? But because on the one hand we're not told, and so we kind of have to make suppositions. And by the end of the day, there's no way to confirm. But one of the things that I guess comes to my mind is, so he knows that the ark is in Jerusalem, which is where he's living. So it's certainly not more convenient. But I think maybe there is a convenience, an appeal, if you will, to kind of like we go on retreats today or whatever. So because Solomon is the king, he doesn't feel he can do whatever without all the pomp and circumstance that would come with being the king in the king's city. And so he goes somewhere else. Not saying it's right, but I'm saying I could see something like that being one of the reasons. So if we go back to keep your finger in Deuteronomy 12, we'll come back to it. But let's go to 1 Kings 3 here. There's several passages we're going to kind of call our way back to. 1 Kings 3. So when we walk through this, we see people were sacrificing at the high places because no house for the had yet been built for the name of the Lord. And so the law of centralization hasn't truly come into effect yet. Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the ways and the statutes of David his father. So, you know, I would attribute his motives to being pious. You know, he loves the Lord and is trying to please God. That's what the text says. So I would take that at face value. Except that he sacrificed and made offerings at the high places. And the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great thing, or the great high place. Solomon used to offer 1,000 burnt offerings on the altar. And so the Lord appears to Solomon. And Solomon, when Solomon starts to answer, we notice that, one, Solomon gives this lengthy detailing of all of the blessings of God on himself and David and the kingdom through them before we get to the request. And so one of the things that we see is that in the request itself, actually, so give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil, for who is able to govern this, your great people? Solomon wants to be a good king. If you would, turn back with me to 1 Samuel 12. I'm going to try not to jump around too much here, but I think this is kind of an important cross-reference. So we talked about this when we were flying, or when we flew past it the first time. But 1 Samuel 12, verses 12 to 18. This is Samuel's farewell address. So Samuel is about to end his reign as judge because there's a king who's coming into effect. And so because of that, the people have asked for the king, and God has told Samuel to give them one. So starting at verse 12, we see, "And when you saw that Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, came against you, you said to me, 'No, but a king shall reign over us,' when the Lord your God was your king. And now behold, the king whom you have chosen, whom you have asked, or for whom you have asked, behold, the Lord has set a king over you. If you will fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and not rebel against the commandment of the king, if both you and the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God, it will be well. But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you and your king. Now, therefore, stand still and see this great thing that the Lord will do before your eyes. Is it not wheat harvest today? Why did I go to 18? I don't know. We should stop right there. So we get this refrain that kind of keeps going on of, it used to be, if the Israelites will hearken to the Lord's voice, if the Israelites will listen to the Lord and will fulfill his commands, then all will go well in the land and they will prosper and they'll keep the land and so on and so forth. Now, there's an extra condition. It's not enough for the Israelites to do it. The Israelites and their king must do it. I'm not going to draw the point out a whole lot here, but just say, keep this in mind as we're moving forward and we start seeing all of these kings who fall short. So Solomon desires to be the good king that we're being told is necessary for Israel to remain prosperous and to remain in the land. We see in 1 Kings 4, for example, that God blesses Solomon not only with the wisdom that Solomon requested, but also with significant material blessing. And so we see, this is, 1 Kings 4, verses 20 to 26. Judah and Israel were as many as the sand by the sea. They ate and drank and were happy. Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines and to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Solomon's provision for one day was 60 cores of the fine flour and 60 cores of meal, 10 fat oxen, 20 pasture-fed cattle, 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fattened fowl, for he had dominion over all the region west of the Euphrates, from Tifsa to Gaza, over all the kings west of the Euphrates, and he had peace on all sides around him. And Judah and Israel lived in safety, from Dan even to Beersheba, every man under the vine and under his fig tree, all the days of Solomon. Solomon also had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. And those officers supplied provisions for King Solomon and for all who came to Solomon's table, each one in his month. They let nothing be lacking, barley also, straw for the horses, swift steeds they brought to the place where it was required, each according to his duty. I'm going to stop there, but we should be getting a picture of just how wealthy Solomon was. And it should also kind of call our minds back to Deuteronomy 17. we'll go look at Deuteronomy 17 here in a bit, but I want to go ahead and keep looking at Solomon while we're here. So we see that God has given Solomon great material blessing. I thought there was also something in that passage that talked about all the wives. Oh, it's later. Okay. So the other thing that we see that truly is spectacular during Solomon's reign is the building of the temple. And so we saw in that 1 Kings 4 that Judah and Israel lived in safety across the entire land during Solomon's reign. And so, based on a couple of the things we've already read here today even, in 1 Kings 5 through 8, we see the temple being built. And when the temple now comes into being, God is saying that this is the place. This is the place where you are to sacrifice to God. This is the place where you are to worship God. And no other place is acceptable. So let's look at a couple of the passages for where, I don't want to read through the whole building of the temple. So we're going to look at a couple of places where, I guess that are particularly, I think, kind of capture the essence of it. 1 Kings 8, verses 10 and 11, if somebody would like to read that for us. 1 Kings 8, verses 10 and 11. And so we have the temple now, and now we've got this. If you remember when the Israelites were wandering through the wilderness, they're led by a pillar of fire by night and a pillar of cloud by day. So again, now we're getting some of that same literal picture of the cloud of the glory of the Lord filling the temple. We get the same passage in 2 Chronicles 5, verses 13 and 14. Almost to a word. Oh, yeah, there it is. 2 Chronicles 5, 13 and 14. 13 is a bit longer. But if you start down about halfway through the verse, we see, "And when the song was raised with trumpets and cymbals and other musical instruments in praise to the Lord, for he is good and his steadfast love endures forever, the house of the Lord was filled with a cloud, so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of God." In 2 Chronicles 7, verses 1 to 3, we see similarly, as soon as Solomon finished his prayer, fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. And the priests could not enter the house of the Lord because the glory of the Lord filled the Lord's house. When all the people of Israel saw the fire come down and the glory of the Lord on the temple, they bowed down with their faces to the ground on the pavement and worshipped and gave thanks to the Lord, saying, "For he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever." And so, I guess one of the things that we really should take away from this is what happens when God indwells his temple? Something changes, right? Something fundamentally changes. And it drives out even the priests of Israel. If you remember, it's been quite a while now, when we were in the other series, we kind of talked about how there was almost a hierarchy of holiness built into Israelite law. Is that ringing a little bit of a bell? And so one of the ways that plays out then is that we see holy people. And so we have those who are outside the camp, and then we have the Israelites themselves. And even within the Israelites, we get the Levites who are called out from that. And even from within the Levites, then we get the priests who are called out. And even within the priests, we get the high priest specifically who's called out. And that comes with it different levels of holy actions. So only the priests then can offer sacrifice. The Levites then are responsible for carrying the parts of the tabernacle. The high priest himself is the only one, and even him only once a year, who can enter the holy of holies within the temple. And yet here we're told that when God comes and God enters the temple, they can't stand to, they're chased out. And that should make an impact on us, you know? We haven't gotten to that point yet, but yes. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I always think back to, and I can't find it real quick here, but the parable of Lazarus and the rich man in Luke. And one of the, the rich man who dies and goes to hell in the parable, the last request that he makes is that send Lazarus to my family. Send them some other witness. And the reply that Abraham gives to the rich man is something to the effect of, if they don't believe all that Moses and the prophets have told them, even if someone was to rise from the dead, it wouldn't make a difference. And particularly in Luke's gospel, as where you're at in Luke's gospel when that happens, it's on the road to the cross and to the resurrection. And so in that context, Luke knows that someone will rise from the dead and people still won't believe. So, we see all of this terrific material blessing, if you will, all of this blessing on the realm of Israel, all of this seemingly terrific stuff that's happening under the reign of Solomon. And yet, it doesn't take very long before we start seeing things happening in Solomon's reign that are not good. And by the end, it winds up where Solomon falls away. And so if we look back at 1 Kings 3, we didn't read verse 1 for a reason. Because as early as 1 Kings 3, we see that Solomon made a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. He took Pharaoh's daughter, brought her into the city of David until he had finished the building of his own house and the kingdom and the house of the Lord, and the wall around Jerusalem. So again, he's going out and marrying pagans. And particularly Egypt. It's utterly shocking, is the only way I can really say it, that Israel time and again turns to Egypt. And we haven't quite gotten to this point yet, but every time that there's a major military struggle, Israel looks to Egypt over and over and over again. They see Assyria coming. Well, maybe we can make a deal with Egypt and they'll protect us. Babylon comes. Well, maybe we can make a deal with the Assyrians. Egyptians. And they'll protect us. It never works. And it's the rankest form of idolatry. It's looking to these people to deliver us instead of God, when God has already demonstrated his superiority. Not at this point. We'll get to that question here in just a second. No worries. No, it's great that you're thinking that far ahead. But it gets worse, is the short answer. So if you turn with me to 1 Kings 9, And I'm going to read verses 1 to 9 here. As soon as Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house and all that Solomon desired to build, the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time, as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. And the Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your plea, which you have made before me. I have consecrated this house that you have built by putting my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will be there for all time. And as for you, if you will walk before me as David your father walked, with integrity of heart and uprightness, doing according to all that I have commanded you and keeping my statutes and my rules, then I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever, as I promised David your father, saying, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. But if you turn aside from following me, you or your children, and do not keep my commandments and my statutes that I have set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land that I have given them, and the house that I have consecrated for my name I will cast out of my sight. And Israel will become a proverb and a byword among all the peoples. And this house will become a heap of ruins. Everyone passing by it will be astonished and will hiss, and they will say, why has the Lord done this to this land and to this house? Then they will say, because they abandoned the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt, and laid hold on other gods, and worshipped them, and served them. Therefore the Lord has brought all this disaster on them. And so already we're seeing that there are conditions. We saw it back in Deuteronomy, we saw it back before that. There are conditions to the people being in the land, that they would live long in the land and prosper. And if they're not willing to meet those conditions or not able to meet those conditions, then there are curses that follow. And so here we see Solomon given basically the same understanding. It's a little bit more personal for him because he's the king. And it doesn't take very long. By 1 Kings 11, we'll read a little chunk here. We see that now King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women from the nations, concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, you shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn your heart after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love. He had 700 wives who were princesses and 300 concubines. And his wives turned away his heart. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods. His heart was not holy to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. So Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not wholly follow the Lord, as David his father had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites, on the mountain east of Jerusalem. And so he did for all his foreign wives, who made offerings and sacrifice to their gods. And the Lord was angry with Solomon, because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice, and had commanded him concerning this thing that he should not go after other gods. But he did not keep what the Lord commanded. And therefore the Lord said to Solomon, since this has been your practice, and you have not kept my commandment, or my covenant, and my statutes that I commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you, and will give it to your servant. Yet for the sake of David your father, I will not do it in your days, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away all the kingdom, but will give one tribe to your son for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem that I have chosen. And the Lord raised up an adversary against Solomon, and we'll leave it there for now. And so, yep, Kim? The second time he offers him a choice. Yeah, at some level. But really, the third dime is the declaration. It's the conclusion of the previous visit. So Solomon has made his choice from the previous visit, and he's shown that by the way that he's lived. And so then when God does, or when we do hear from God again concerning what Solomon has done, it's a word of judgment. Yeah. Yeah. And so again, we see that Solomon has made this turn, and not in a good way. Solomon has started going after these other gods. But you'll notice, or I hope you notice, that one of the things that we say is that Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and did not wholly follow the Lord. That word holy is really important. Holy with a W. One of the things that we see in the Old Testament, and quite frankly in our lives today, is not this complete turning away from God. It's not, I don't accept this God, but this other one is good. God is great. He's real. He's the living God. But, you know, I also kind of like this other thing. Maybe they can just kind of coexist. And so we get syncretism, which we've talked about before. But it's this idea that God and so I can, this idea that I can worship God and money. I can worship God and success or fame or whatever. And one of the things that the Bible condemns most strongly is that syncretism. Not that rank idolatry and just turning away from God totally is blessed by any stretch of the imagination, but what it's saying is that this syncretism is no better. Because it is a denial of God. No man can serve two masters. And with that, I see that my time is up, but... Are there any questions with anything else that y'all would like to see? We're going to kind of go into Solomon's son next week and talk about how the kingdom splits and kind of how that progression spirals downhill to the exile. Not necessarily. And so last week we talked about how David's two oldest sons actually were disinherited and ultimately killed. But both tried to claim the kingship while David was still alive. Solomon was the second son of Bathsheba, who was far from David's first wife. And so even within the line of David, God still is choosing his king. But the pool is slightly more restricted by God's own decree. That makes sense? Okay. So on that note, we'll close out with prayer and get moving with the service. Father, thank you.